It might be thought that, as a member, all the doings of the society would be told to him. But he was soon to discover that the organization was wider and more complex than the simple lodge. Even Boss McGinty was ignorant as to many things, for there was an official named the county delegate living at Hobson's Patch farther down the line, who had power over several different lodges which he wielded in a sudden and arbitrary way. Only once did McMurdo see him, a sly little grey-haired rat of a man with a slinking gait and a sidelong glance which was charged with malice. Evans Pott was his name, and even the great boss of Vermisso felt towards him something of the repulsion and fear which the huge Danton may have felt for the puny but dangerous Robespierre. One day, Scanlon, who was McMurdo's fellow boarder, received a note from McGinty, enclosing one from Evans Pott, which informed him that he was sending over two good men, Lawler and Andrews, who had instructions to act in the neighbourhood. Thought it was best for the cause that no particulars as to their objects should be given. Would the bodymaster see to it that suitable arrangements be made for their lodgings and comfort until the time for action should arrive? McGinty added that it was impossible for anyone to remain secret at the Union House, and that, therefore, he would be obliged if McMurdo and Scanlon would put the strangers up for a few days in their boarding house. The same evening, the two men arrived, each carrying his gripsack. Lawler was an elderly man, shrewd, silent, and self-contained, clad in an old black frock coat, which, with his soft felt hat and ragged grizzled beard, gave him a general resemblance to an itinerant preacher. His companion, Andrews, was little more than a boy, frank-faced and cheerful, with the breezy manner of one who is out for a holiday and means to enjoy every minute of it. Both men were total abstainers, and behaved in all ways as exemplary members of the society, with the one simple exception that they were assassins who had often proved themselves to be most capable instruments for this association of murder. Lawler had already carried out 14 commissions of the kind, and Andrews 3. They were, as McMurdo found, quite ready to converse about their deeds in the past, which they recounted with the half-bashful pride of men who had done good and unselfish service for the community. They were reticent, however, as to the immediate job in hand. "They chose us because neither I nor the boy here drink," Lawler explained. "They can count on us saying no more than we should. You must not take it amiss, but it is the orders of the county delegate that we obey." "Sure, we are all in it together," said Scanlon, McMurdo's mate, as the four sat together at supper. "That's true enough, and we'll talk till the cows come home of the killing of Charlie Williams, or of Simon Bird, or any other job in the past. But till the work is done, we say nothing." "There are half a dozen about here that I have a word to say to," said McMurdo, with an oath. "I suppose it isn't Jack Knox or Ironhill that you are after. I'd go some way to see him get his deserts." "No, it's not him yet." "Or Herman Strauss?" "No, nor him either." "Well, if you won't tell us, we can't make you. But I'd be glad to know." Lawler smiled and shook his head. He was not to be drawn. In spite of the reticence of their guests, Scanlon and McMurdo were quite determined to be present at what they called the fun. When, therefore, at an early hour one morning, McMurdo heard them creeping down the stairs, he awakened Scanlon, and the two hurried on their clothes. When they were dressed, they found that the others had stolen out, leaving the door open behind them. It was not yet dawn, and by the light of the lamps they could see the two men some distance down the street. They followed them warily, treading noiselessly in the deep snow. The boarding house was near the edge of the town, and soon they were at the crossroads, which is beyond its boundary. Here three men were waiting, with whom Lawler and Andrews held a short, eager conversation. Then they all moved on together. It was clearly some notable job which needed numbers. At this point there are several trades which led to various mines. The strangers took that which led to the Crow Hill, a huge business which was in strong hands, which had been able, thanks to their energetic and fearless New England manager, Josiah H. Dunn, to keep some order and discipline during the long reign of terror. Day was breaking now, and a line of workmen were slowly making their way, singly and in groups, along the blackened path. McMurdo and Scanlon strolled on with the others, keeping in sight of the men whom they followed. A thick mist lay over them, and from the heart of it there came the sudden scream of a steam whistle. It was a 10-minute signal before the cages descended and the day's labor began. When they reached the open space round the mine shaft, there were 100 miners waiting, stamping their feet and blowing on their fingers, for it was bitterly cold. The strangers stood in a little group under the shadow of the engine house. Scanlon and McMurdo climbed the heap of slag from which the whole scene lay before them. They saw the mine engineer, a great bearded Scotchman named Menzies, come out of the engine house and blow his whistle for the cages to be lowered. At the same instant, a tall, loose-framed young man with a clean-shaved, earnest face advanced eagerly towards the pithead. As he came forward, his eyes fell upon the group, silent and motionless, under the engine house. The men had drawn down their hats and turned up their collars to screen their faces. For a moment, the presentiment of death laid its cold hand upon the manager's heart. At the next, he had shaken it off and saw only his duty towards intrusive strangers. "Who are you?" he asked as he advanced. "What are you loitering there for?" There was no answer, but the lad, Andrews, stepped forward and shot him in the stomach. The 100 waiting miners stood as motionless and helpless as if they were paralyzed. The manager clapped his two hands to the wound and doubled himself up. Then he staggered away, but another of the assassins fired, and he went down sidewise, kicking and clawing among a heap of clinkers. Menzies, the Scotchman, gave a roar of rage at the sight and rushed with an iron spanner at the murderers, but was met by 2 balls in the face which dropped him dead at their very feet. There was a surge forward of some of the miners, and an inarticulate cry of pity and of anger, but a couple of the strangers emptied their 6-shooters over the heads of the crowd, and they broke and scattered, some of them rushing wildly back to their homes in Vermissa. When a few of the bravest had rallied, and there was a return to the mine, the murderous gang had vanished in the mists of morning, without a single witness being able to swear to the identity of these men who, in front of 100 spectators, had wrought this double crime. Scanlon and McMurdo made their way back. Scanlon, somewhat subdued, for it was the first murder job that he had seen with his own eyes, and it appeared less funny than he had been led to believe. The horrible screams of the dead manager's wife pursued them as they hurried to the town. McMurdo was absorbed and silent, but he showed no sympathy for the weakening of his companion. "Sure, it is like a war," he repeated. "What is it but a war between us and them, and we hit back where we best can?" There was high revel in the lodge room at the Union House that night, not only over the killing of the manager and the engineer of the Crow Hill mine, which would bring this organization into line with the other blackmailed and terror-stricken companies of the district, but also over a distant triumph which had been wrought by the hands of the lodge itself. It would appear that when the county delegate had sent over 5 good men to strike a blow in Vermissa, he had demanded that in return 3 Vermissa men should be secretly selected and sent across to kill William Hales of Stake Royal, one of the best-known and most popular mine owners in the Gilmerton district, a man who was believed not to have an enemy in the world, for he was in all ways a model employer. He had insisted, however, upon efficiency in the work, and had, therefore, paid off certain drunken and idle employees who were members of the all-powerful society. Coffin notices hung outside his door had not weakened his resolution, and so in the free, civilized country he found himself condemned to death.